Hey, deserving listeners. Today's episode is about dating. And I've done a recent episode about this already, but so many more questions were left unanswered, and so I thought I would get to those questions. And a little caveat before getting into this is that dating is a very complicated thing. And often in advice columns on the internet or in the newspaper, it's often portrayed as this really simple thing, as if there's these really simple answers that are generalizable to every human being, and that's just ridiculous. So as I talk about this, I'm going to try to speak from that place, that everyone comes from a different place. Problems can have multi, you know, factors that when I talk about things, whenever I talk about things, it should be taken with that in mind, and that if you're having a particular problem that you need help with, you should find professional in-person help that can assess your full situation and apply a treatment plan just for you. But let's get to an email here. This first one is from anonymous patron. She writes, "Given that sex is expected while dating, how do you navigate that if you don't like having sex? For me, sex is fine, but I'd rather spend my time engaging in one of my hobbies and could honestly be in a relationship without ever doing it. I don't care about having sex in general. I'm often uncomfortable talking about sex with potential partners because of my disdain for it." All right, just chiming in here. Yeah, I get it. We live in a very strange world that doesn't acknowledge that some people just don't like having sex or don't want to, especially in dating, especially for young people. And it's a thing. There's plenty of people who don't want to have sex for a while, or and there's various reasons why people don't want to have sex. One is just being asexual or demisexual, meaning that essentially you have a sexual orientation or a biological preference that sex just isn't a big part of your life. We can all imagine that there's a spectrum and maybe a bell curve, with people in the middle having an average sex drive, and you have people at the high end who have very high sex drive, and you have people at the low end who essentially have no sex drive at all. And that shouldn't be that foreign or that difficult to understand. And there's a good percentage of people who identify as asexual or demisexual, and they're just not as interested in sex, and they notice that difference between them and other people. There are other reasons why people don't want to have sex, particularly while dating. It's a very vulnerable thing. There's a lot of consequences to it. It can be fraught with all sorts of things, and dating involves a lot of different elements. You know, it involves having fun and socializing, getting to know someone, romance, affection, empathy, support, warmth, building a life together, hobbies. And so sex, you know, it's just one part of it. And certainly you could do without one part of the dating thing if you wanted to. So the two things, anonymous patron, I would say to strive for are to look for someone like you. There are people like you, people who are just the same as you for one reason or another, particularly during dating, that they just don't want to have sex. And to expect that you're not going to find someone like you is not an accurate expectation. So it might take a little bit longer because you're dealing perhaps with one end of the bell curve, but that end of the bell curve might be bigger than you think it is. The second thing to look for is someone who likes you for who you are and what you want. So this person might want to have sex in the beginning, but likes you enough that they're willing to sacrifice that preference for who you are. And so when the time is right, let it out, or just say it from the beginning. There are probably dating websites where this is actually an option to say. I'm quite positive that that must be an option. And so you can go to dating websites and just click on either asexual or some kind of indication that says, look, I'm just throwing this out there. I'm not really interested in having sex right from the beginning, but I'm very interested in all the other aspects of dating. And there's someone, a whole bevy of people out there that would be like, oh my God, I want to be with that person. That sounds so nice. Or people out there just like, well, you can't have it all in the beginning of a relationship, and I like everything else that I see on the profile. So it's a good litmus test. You want to eliminate those. And really, it should be truth in advertising, right? If you will, that you should tell people right from the beginning, as soon as you can, just like, by the way, here's my preference, because you don't want to go down 10 dates and then spring that on someone. And then they're like, wait a second, I didn't know that about you, and because that's kind of a deal breaker for me. So find your people, find the people who are like you or who like you for who you are, and you know, move on with life. And I get it. You know, we live in a very broken society that shames and stigmatizes these kinds of things. And, you know, just, you know, do your best to combat that in your mind. There's nothing wrong with you. All right. This next email is from Leslie. Leslie writes, "Have you ever covered the topic of interabled dating, where a healthy person dates someone who has a disability to some varying degree? My disability will dramatically affect my partner's life, and realistic expectations should come alongside the whole love is enough romanticized ideal. I want very badly to have a relationship and companionship, even though the terminal nature of my condition means that my life expectancy is much shorter. The truth that a healthy, happy, loving, interabled relationship is extremely possible seems to get lost. I feel that there should be a much more open conversation about the harmful stigmas facing interabled couples. The healthy partner has to balance their caregiver role with the role of lover and friend. This often makes things more difficult than the disability itself. People tend to have weird fetishes. They see you as a charity project. They use you as an object that helps them feel better about who they are. Also, not everyone is cut out to handle extreme and challenging maintenance of their partner, bathing their partner, toileting their partner, giving them medications through IVs, feeding them through tubes." End of email. Yeah, Leslie, I'm glad that you emailed me about this. I've been wanting to talk about this for a long time, and yes, it is almost never discussed. And of course, it makes sense, right? Most people want companionship. Most people want long-term romantic relationships. And people who have health issues that make it difficult for them to get around or difficult to even go to the bathroom by themselves or even to bathe. Of course, those people, if they want, most people want romance. Not everyone wants romance. Not everyone wants sex in their life. But most people do, meaning most people who have a disability also want romance and companionship and sex in their life. And so we often, as a society, just look at some people and say, oh, well, yeah, sexuality or romance or companionship, that's just really not going to happen. And why? I mean, it's like, why not? This is such a stupid thing. Is yeah, they're too far gone. There's just no way it's going to work. And that's just, you know, it's so much easier for abled people to do that, right? Just be like, well, I don't want to deal with it. So let's just not have that on the table because I don't want to have to think about that or deal with it. And yeah, you know, I hadn't heard this angle of it before, but people dating disabled people might have a weird fetish, which could make you feel objectified, of course, that they see you as a charity project or as a way to make themselves feel better because they feel bad about themselves. Yeah, I mean, that sounds really rough. I will say that for even people who don't have a disability, it's not like dating is a walk in the park. So I'm guessing that these additional factors make it additionally hard, but I'm guessing you also would experience all the other foibles of regular dating. Yeah, I don't know what to say. It's not really my area. I don't have any clinical experience with this and very little personal experience with it. But Leslie, you raised the awareness of me a little bit. I learned a little bit from your email, and now the listeners have as well. So let's all do what we can to not dismiss and discount and turn away and make invisible human beings who have disabilities, to not say, well, they're too far gone, or whatever we say to our stupid selves that denies a certain section of the human race a right to this sort of things that people should have if they want it. And that the stigma around it or the discomfort around it, you know, we just have to get over ourselves, really. All right, let's go on to another email. All right, this next is just a comment from YouTube. Adina from YouTube, she says, me and my boyfriend have found ourselves at a plateau in our relationship. And while I want to keep working on our relationship, he says we have nothing good going for us anymore. How can we keep the spark alive while long-distance dating during the pandemic? Well, Adina, that's a tough one. Whenever there are these kinds of questions, I usually try to look for something to grab onto, generally speaking, because, of course, I don't know your particular situation. But the detail you give here is you want to keep working on your relationship, but he says that you have nothing good going for you anymore. So I understand that it sounds like you want to retain the relationship. You see potential there. But from the way you characterize that, it sounds like he doesn't. And what to do about that, I don't know. I guess you'd start from the beginning of just trying to help him, if you can, see what you see in the relationship, and maybe that'll inspire him to want to work on the relationship as well. But there's a possibility that he doesn't want to be with you anymore, and that's sad, and you do what you can, but you also have to take care of yourself and not overextend yourself chasing something that you'll never be able to catch. So, and then you ask this other question, how can we keep the spark alive while long-distance dating during the pandemic? You know, this is a difficult one, too. I've been getting this question ever since the pandemic started, and I just don't know the answer. I wish that and of course, the internet has all these answers, and I've even been interviewed for different articles and other sorts of things on this topic. People reach out to me and say, you know, what do we do during the pandemic, whether it's clinical or social or romantic or mental health or something. And there are things we can do, right? Obviously, video chatting, social distance, socializing, like going for a walk while standing 6 feet apart, getting animals in your house. That's what we've done. Just added another puppy to our lives, and that livens up the house a little bit. Having hobbies, taking care of yourself, good sleep, you know, all those kinds of things. But, you know, fundamentally, we are not made for this kind of life. We are not made to be the Unabomber. We are not made to isolate ourselves. And although we have access, like never before, of the internet to have screen time with people, that's not the same. It's not natural. It's like looking at a picture of nature as opposed to being in nature. When we get something out of it. It's not like a picture of nature is nice, and a Zoom call with a loved one is nice, but it's not our natural state. And maybe in the future we'll find that we can adapt to it, but I can't adapt. It's not like after the pandemic I'm going to be like, well, I mean, it's so much more convenient to socialize over Zoom. No. Like I am done. I am just done with this pandemic. And when the vaccine is available to people in my category, I'm going to be first in line. Just, I don't care which one it is, as long as it's been tested sufficiently, just give it to me. I want this to be over. So I don't have any good advice, really. Keeping the spark alive while your relationship is suffering and you're in a long-distance situation, you can't see each other. You know, of course, you can create a pod, right, where you, or whatever people are calling it, where both of you long-distance try not to see other people, and you try to see each other in person. Anyway, let's go on to another question. India Dawkins on YouTube says, how do you successfully go from a normal relationship where you live together and see each other regularly to a long-distance relationship, especially if you've been together for a while? Yeah, same thing. I mean, I have tips for long-distance relationships. I have a whole episode on it. You can listen to that. But from my memory, it was try to see each other in person as much as you can. Try to be involved in each other's daily lives through phone calls and texts, other kinds of things. But it can be done, for sure. Lots of people survive long-distance portions of their relationship. So it's not like it can't be done. But the key is that you want to do all the normal things in a relationship, like listen to each other and express your needs in a non-accusatory way. But you have to do these extra things that would happen naturally if you did see each other in person, you know. I remember the other tip was make sure that you communicate about how to communicate. Don't assume that the other person wants to communicate in the way you do. One person might want to text 100 times a day. The other person might want to talk on the phone an hour every 2 days. You know, don't assume that the other person has the same style or preference as you do. And doesn't mean you don't compromise. It might mean, but don't just forge ahead. And don't ignore the other person's signals about how they want to communicate. You know, you want to communicate about how you're going to communicate. Kat Piller on YouTube says, are long-distance relationships a good idea? Yeah. I mean, they're not a bad idea. How you do them, though, the other factor in addition to what I've been saying is if you start it as a long-term relationship, that's harder. And I think the research from – I listened to my whole deep dive on it, but I seem to remember there's some research suggesting that if the relationship – very quickly transitions to long distance or starts out as long distance, then the success rate goes down. Whereas if you have a good chance to bond in person for a good amount of time or a sufficient amount of time, then it will help to sustain the bad times of a long distance once you become long distance. Anyway. All right, this next email is from Maria. Maria said, I'm in a very happy long-term relationship. I found that many of my friends who struggle with dating have unreasonable expectations. They desire a fairy tale romance and come to me with disappointments when their dreams fall short of their realities. I tell them that I think they should be more practical, but in truth, they don't really like this perspective. Many of them interpret my suggestion as telling them to settle for less than they deserve. Do you find that people over-idealize relationships? Am I not being fair to my friends for giving the advice I do? End of email. I'll say it's hard to say because it could be one of two things. One is it could be that they are indeed striving for what they deserve and want and that they shouldn't settle. Certainly there's some wisdom to that depending on that situation. Or the other is that you're right, which is that they are striving essentially for the impossible and that they'll never get their needs met because they have unrealistic expectations. It's hard to know. What are we talking about here? I'd have to hear the expectations, that sort of thing. And to answer your question, yes, some people definitely idealize, particularly younger people. No offense, younger people, but people who haven't been in long-term relationships. People who have been in long-term relationships understand that things are complicated and relationships are work and no partner is perfect. And the best partner will have major flaws that will annoy you the rest of your life. And research has shown that the best couples on the planet who, you know, are in love their entire life and have relatively few conflicts will talk about how their partner annoys them in the same three ways for their entire life and they just never resolve it, you know? So people who have been in long-term relationships understand that. And it makes sense that people have unrealistic expectations because where would they learn otherwise? Every rom-com, every music video, every story that, young adults read in general, it's all completely idealized. I mean, think about Harry Potter, the way romance is depicted in Harry Potter. And of course, there are some nuances to it, but rightfully so, they don't get into what it feels like to be married to someone for 15 years, right? I mean, I guess you could say that, the aunt and uncle exhibit some kind of difficulty. But anyway, the point is that, we don't teach kids this and people tend to protect children for good reasons around this information. So it makes sense that younger people who haven't been in long-term relationships have huge fairy tale romance. The other thing is that, and I think this is getting worse, honestly, that since we live kind of in an Instagram world now, there's a lot of young people who incorporate Instagram or their internet persona into their ideas about romance, which of course is fine. There's pros and cons, and of course everyone would pathologize that, but it's just a part of our life now, and we have to think about the pros and the cons. And one of the cons is that if you are looking on Instagram for examples of romance, then you are likely to have a very overblown fairy tale, unrealistic expectation of what romance looks like. I mean, if you look at, me and my wife, I post pictures of us on Instagram. And if we're having issues, I'm not going to take a picture and post that on Instagram. That's just not the Instagram way. I suppose maybe I should lead the way and do that. But, you know, the point is that you're 22 and a lot of your social education is happening on Instagram, and also not only just famous people, but also your friends. And you want that, you know, you want what that looks like. And you might even be just trying to get those pictures. That might be literally how you see romance, of like, okay, that's what a good life is finding someone that is photogenic, essentially. Someone that has great abs and does their hair right and shoots well, you know, in a selfie. And yeah, there are some massive problems with that. You know, love is so much bigger than that. And we evolved to connect to people based on emotional safety and on having similar values and building a life together and stability and compatible, you know, sense of humor and these kinds of things. And of course, there's nothing wrong with having Instagram compatibility a part of that, whether you're, you know, like two people who hate Instagram probably fit well together in that way and vice versa. But anyway, yeah, people idealize and have always idealized, and that's fine. So the other thing I'll say is that I'm not pathologizing younger people. When I was young, I did it too. I kind of consider it a part of the growing up process that, and I remember saying this is when I was, before I was a therapist, I had all these kinds of therapist-y things that I would come up with, these little wisdoms that I even called them little wisdoms at times. I had a song in high school where I actually referenced these little wisdoms. But one of the little, quote unquote, little, and I was sort of making fun of myself at the time too, but one of these little wisdoms that I developed was that you're not an adult until you have had your heart broken. And I don't know if I still believe that, but when I was 17 or however old I was when I came up with that, I noticed that me and the people around me, there was us before our heart was broken and us after our heart was broken. And we were definitely different people. Before the heartbreak, there was innocence and idealization and fairy tales and wading into the fray without any fear and openness and delusion and an expectation that things will be fine in romance, and falling hard in love, like just blind jumping off of the cliff. And then there was us after our heart was broken, which was much more wary, much more realistic, much more protective, and opening up when the time was right and sort of proven to us. And of course, there's pros and cons to either one of those sides, right? You know, the defended side has its problems. But anyway, this is along those lines of when you have an, it's, there's being ideal, being, when people idealize, that's not a problem. It's just a part of the phases of growing up. And if you have enough relationships, you very quickly learn that the ideal is not attainable, or likely the ideal that you hold in your mind. And being told that by a friend might not necessarily work. And so you ask, Maria, is it fair for you to try to disabuse your friends of this notion of idealized relationship? Well, the questions you want to ask are you hurting their feelings, and are they listening? Because if you're hurting their feelings to such a degree that you're doing a lot of damage, then no, it's not fair. The other is, if you're convincing, then maybe it is fair. Maybe the truth hurts, you know. But if they're not hearing you, which it kind of sounds like they're not, then what's the point? And that might get to my point of you just have to live life. You just have to learn yourself. In the beginning of my career, I treated a lot of kids and teenagers, and it was a very frequent point of conflict where these 14-year-olds would have these just completely unrealistic expectations of what the future held for them. They would be like not going to school or not trying in school. They'd be smoking pot every day with their friends, and they'd be screaming at their parents. They'd be like, "I want out of here." And the parents would be conflicting with them, and I'd sit down with the kid and I'd be like, "Well, okay, so you want to move out? Yeah, I want to be emancipated." And I'd give them the whole spiel about realistic emancipation, which is extremely difficult to attain. But they heard about it through the grapevine. I said, "Okay, you want to be emancipated. All right, let's say we wave a magic wand and you're emancipated. Then what?" "Oh, well, you know, I'll figure something out." And I'll be like, "Well, what do you mean? You're going to be homeless? What are you going to do?" "Oh, you know, I got friends. Yeah, I have a friend and he lends me money sometimes." "All right, how could you give me a figure? How much?" You know, it was never realistic, right? And you can yell at a 14-year-old and say, "You have unrealistic expectations. You don't understand." Well, until they grow up and they're 18 and they move out and they realize how very, you know, little $1,000 buys you, they just won't understand. They just won't get it. So you just have to go through those steps in life. You know, I remember when I was in college, I remember thinking, all I need is a low paying regular job and I'll be fine. Just $30,000 a year and I'll be fine. Now, of course, this is, you know, $1995, but still, I remember thinking that $30,000 would be fine. And $30,000 is probably below the poverty line in Seattle. And you're not going to be able to pay your bills on in Seattle anyway. Anyway, my point is that you can be smart, but until you live it, you just don't know. Anyway, let's go on to another email. All right. Haley Penn on YouTube asked, "I'm from South Asia, and dating before being old enough to marry by our society's standards is considered a sign of bad upbringing. Would it be wrong for me to date this guy that I like? My parents are conservative and would not approve. Any help is appreciated." All right. So, Haley, you're saying you're from South Asia, and in your culture, dating before you're old enough is considered a sign of bad upbringing. It's like shameful on your parents, right? And you're asking, you know, would it be wrong for you to date a guy that you like? Your parents are conservative and would not approve. I don't know the answer, Haley. From my Seattle cultural perspective, I would wish that you could date who you want to, depending on how old you are. I don't know. You don't say how old you are, but depending on how old you are, then in my culture, then I would say, yeah, you should be. But it's more important that your family life go well. You know, dating when you're 16 is important and perhaps a big part of some people's lives, but usually a bigger part of our life is our family. And also, if you just forge ahead against your culture and against your family, that could be really unsafe in a lot of ways, literally. And so, although I understand from my cultural perspective, if my parents, when I was a teenager, I don't even know how old you are, prevented me from dating, that would be pretty rough, and I would not feel good about that. So, but my culture would have supported it. So, you know, if your culture and your family don't support it, yeah, that's tough. And I don't know what to do. You know, if I was in your culture, if I knew your situation, I might be able to advise a little bit more. But even then, I'd probably say the same thing because you're there living your life. Now, the thing to think about is that dating as a behavior usually is something we're always trying to get our needs met. That's an important thing to remember. So we're not trying to date. We're trying to get our needs met through dating. So if you can figure out what needs you need to be met, through other ways besides dating. Like maybe what you're looking for a number of needs being met. Like you need companionship and romance and maybe sexual experimentation and fun and humor and something to do on the weekends. Well, some of those needs can be met through friends, right? And maybe you wait on the other needs being met until your family and your culture can approve. So maybe that's what I'll say to that. All right. Actually, let's go to a break. We'll get back. Let's continue reading these emails. All right, we're back from the break. This next message is from Jessa from Facebook. She writes, "Why do people ghost? Ghosting seems to be normalized now, and a lot of my friends won't date for fear of being ghosted. How does one get over their fear of being ghosted?" End of email. Yeah, being ghosted sucks. It's the worst. You like someone or even love someone, and you text them or call them or email them, and you're like, hey, let's hook up this weekend. And they just don't reply. And then, you know, you're getting a little worried after day two. You text them again. They don't get back to you. And then, you know, a couple weeks later, you're just like, I think I've been ghosted. You see them on Instagram or something. You're like, well, I know they're not dead. So there's that. Yeah, it's extremely hurtful. It's, you know, one of the most hurtful relationship experiences you can go through, really. It's just, it's one thing to be dumped. It's another thing just to be like discarded like that. Now, why do people ghost? Well, almost all the time, it's because they are so afraid of disapproval, because they have relational traumas related to disapproval, that they'd rather do something like that than face the music. It doesn't mean that they're a psychopath usually. It doesn't mean that they don't care about you. It doesn't mean that they lack empathy. It usually means that they have underdeveloped empathy and an underdeveloped superego, meaning that they're immature. And two, it's because they're just extremely anxious. There are a lot of people, you know, Umberto actually talks about how he ghosted someone when he was young. I don't know, he's around 20 years old or something, maybe teenager. Well, he didn't know it at the time, but there was a big connection between that and him being abandoned by his mom when he was 2 years old. We could go into the details on that, but I think it's pretty easy to see the connection there. His mom essentially ghosted him. And that creates two things. One is it normalizes being ghosted by a relationship. And two, it makes you feel like you don't matter, and that it makes you feel like you must have done something wrong to be ghosted at the age of two. And you believe that there's something deeply wrong with you. And so as you head into a interaction where you're pretty sure the other person is going to be angry at you, you have overwhelming anxiety of transference related to what you went through as a kid. And you really do not want to return to that feeling. And so you'd rather just run away from it. And ghosting helps you do that. So the thing I'll say about ghosting is that it's going to happen, just like everyone is going to get dumped. Everyone's going to get cheated on, probably. Everyone's going to be treated badly. It just happens. This notion that you can go through dating life and avoid being ghosted, avoid being dumped, avoid being cheated on, avoid being treated badly is just a mismatch of expectations or wrongheadedness. If you're going to head into the reason why dating has so much anxiety for people isn't for no reason. There's a reason why we're terrified of romance. There's a reason why we have butterflies in our stomach on the first date. There's a reason why when we fall in love, we use the phrase falling in love. Falling isn't a good thing. Falling is deeply ingrained in our DNA as a bad thing. Falling out of a tree, falling off a cliff, this was akin to death. And when we fall in love, we use that language because it feels like falling. It feels scary because it is scary. You don't know what you're doing. You don't know what's going to happen. Your life is in someone else's hands. Your heart is in someone else's hands. And the reason why we have that feeling is because we very much know that we can get dumped. We can be treated badly. We can get cheated on. It's going to happen. We're going to get ghosted. It's going to happen. So to avoid dating because you're trying to avoid being dumped or a bad experience is to avoid life. Now, there's nothing wrong with taking a break. There's nothing wrong with saying, I don't want to get into it right now. But to say, I want to date, but I don't want to get dumped. Or I want to have romance, but I don't want to risk being ghosted. Well, that's just wrong-headed thinking. You can't guarantee that. There's just no way to know. And so you're going to have to do it. Like, you can't say, well, I want to become a therapist, but I don't want to flunk a class in graduate school. Or, you know, I want to become a clinician, but I don't want to experience a bad feeling as a clinician when I'm helping people. You got to get your hands dirty. You can't work on the farm and say you want to keep the, you know, your fingernails clean. It's just a part of the thing. You can have that silly wish, but it's going to happen. So if you're going to date, you're going to get ghosted. And I'm not saying that doesn't suck. I mean, like I said, it sucks. It sucks to be dumped. I mean, it is, for some of us, one of the worst experiences of our lives that is retained. The pain of it is retained until the day we die, to be dumped in certain ways. And we have this fantasy that somehow some people can go through life without having that pain and that devastation. It's just not going to happen. So, you know, that's just the way life is. Life is painful. So if you want to live life, you're going to experience pain. I'm not saying you have to date. I'm just saying you can't go into dating with thinking you're not going to get ghosted sometimes. You know what I mean? Now, it doesn't justify ghosting. So let me talk to the ghosters out there. And I know you're out there. When you're afraid, that's fine. You have fear. You're worried about something. Analyze it. Go to therapy. Figure it out. And don't ghost. Ghosting is not an option. There are better options. Now, you might have tremendous fear as you head into that interaction. You know, you're like, oh, I don't want to be with that person anymore. Oh, they texted me. I'm kind of on the fence of this relationship. I'll text them tomorrow. The day goes by, you're like, I'll text them the next day. And then a week goes by and you're like, oh, I haven't texted them a week. Now it's weird to text them. Well, you're in the slippery slope of self-justifying a ghosting process. Stop, think, analyze your anxiety, go to therapy, do the right thing. Do not be immoral and ghost someone. It's wrong. We all understand that. Just call them up or meet them in person and face the music. They're going to disapprove. They're not going to like it. They might get angry at you. And that's partially, well, I'll say it depends on the circumstance, but it's just a part of the process. You know, someone, you break up with them in person, they're going to get hurt and then they're going to get angry and they're going to say things. But know that don't take it personally. They're upset. And they should be upset. The fact that they're upset means that they liked you. That's a good thing that they're upset. If you break up with someone and they're like, oh, thank goodness you broke, I hated you too. It's kind of nice to think, oh, okay, well, I guess this person did like me. But that's just going to happen and it doesn't feel good. You know, there's a lot of shame, but, you know, again, get your therapy, da, da, da. So if you're being dumped, you're being ghosted, get therapy, get support, but figure out the meaning, the existential meaning or the narrative or the schema that you have involved in what being ghosted means. To be ghosted can mean a lot of different things. You can decide what it means to you. It could mean, huh, I guess that person is a scumbag. Good riddance. Dodged a bullet. I mean, if someone ghosts you, one way of looking at it is you dodged a bullet. And you found out early enough that you can move on with your life. It's going to sting. It's going to hurt. But good riddance to that ghoster. Because if they're capable of ghosting, God knows what else they're capable of given their anxiety level, given their immaturity. Whoa, dodged a bullet on that one. Whew. You know, it's sort of like, I can't remember where I heard this, but I actually kind of thought this in my personal life. When you have someone that kind of uses you and they ask for money and you give them money and they, you know, they don't give it back and you hound them for the money and they finally give it back to you. And then they ask for money again and you're just like, look, I'll lend you this money, but I need it back right away because, you know, I'm in a tight situation here. Like, yeah, absolutely. I'll give you the money tomorrow. And then you give them the money and they avoid you. They just never contact you and you never get your money. And like 5 years later, you're like, oh my God, that person still has not contacted me, even though we are pretty good friends. Well, you kind of dodged a bullet you just paid however much money you paid to get that person out of your life. And you're the good guy because you lent them money and you didn't ghost them. They ghosted you. So you're the good person and you got rid of them. You know what I mean? I hope that makes sense. Anyway, so now you have this other idea in here that that ghosting is being normalized. You know, I don't know about that. It's certainly a narrative on the internet, and it'd be a hard thing to research. And certainly, there's not a lot of attention in this area in the social sciences. But in terms of like how much did people ghost in the past, I'm old enough to know that ghosting and bad breakup behavior has been going on for decades. You know, bad breakup behavior wasn't invented when the internet was turned on. I'm here to tell you. So I think that's important for people today who have that narrative of like, oh, dating is so different now. You know, I talk with a lot of young people who are dating and I don't hear that much of a difference. Certainly, there's a difference with regards to dating apps and this sort of thing, but all the same feelings are there. Now, some people will say, oh, you know, hookup culture and disposable relationships because you can just ghost someone and there's a sea of options on Tinder. I think that that's a cynical way of looking at it. Most people, if not everyone that I have ever met who uses even Tinder to date, is looking for love. You know, they're looking for a relationship. And when they find that they don't like someone, yeah, they might ghost or they might, you know, what's the line between ghosting and just saying, yeah, like, and I know there's various different ethical practices, but you know, you go on Tinder, you meet up with someone for coffee and it's a half an hour. And right away you're just like, no, this person is just not going to work. I want to leave. I'll entertain this person for 30 minutes. And then at the end, he says, hey, let's meet up again. And you want to be nice. You're like, yeah, okay. You know, shoot me a message. And then they shoot you a message the next day and you just don't reply. Is that ghosting? Well, on a certain level, yeah, because you kind of said, okay, let's meet up. And certainly in the moment, it's probably a better practice to be like, you know what? I'm not really feeling it, and I'm sorry about that. And so, you know, I hope you have a good life, that kind of thing. It's probably better to be upfront, but certainly, I don't know, there's just a lot. Maybe you're on the fence. You're just like, well, maybe we'll meet up, and then the next day you think back. You're like, nah. And is that ghosting, to just not reply to someone that you barely met? But anyway, my point is that, you know, people are saying that things are different now, and perhaps it is. It definitely looks different. I don't know if it's fundamentally that different, honestly. And the thing that I tell people is expectations. It's all about expectations. And this goes for people of any age. I find this to be true for people at any age. People head into dating relationships with varying different kinds of expectations. Often what people are heading into it with is, I really just hope this goes well. I hope nothing bad happens. I hope that I find someone that I can really like and that likes me and that we can cuddle up to a warm fire and look into each other's eyes. You know, the things that you want. And it's great to want that, but the expectations is the key. So now you can hope for that, but a much more viable expectation as you head into dating would be something like this. You'd say, okay, I'm about to head into dating and I'm going to be realistic about this. What I'm looking for are a number of things. Ultimately, I'm looking for the person I spend the rest of my life with and we have kids and we grow old together. That's what I'm looking for. But it's going to be hard to find that person. Maybe I'll find them on the first try. I probably won't. I might have to go through dozens of people before I meet the right one. There's going to be some fits and starts. A lot of people aren't going to make it to date two. A lot of people aren't going to want me to go to date two. Some people are going to last a month. Most people will not last beyond a month. Some people will last beyond 6 months, you know, maybe one or two. But those people also probably will be those relationships will also probably end. Either we'll both decide, or they'll decide, or I'll decide. I'm going to have to dump people. I'm going to have to be the bad guy, and I'm going to get dumped. I'm going to get dumped on the first date. I'm going to get dumped on the second date. I'm going to get dumped on the 10th date. I'm going to get dumped after 2 years. I'm pretty sure that's going to happen. Someone's going to cheat on me. Someone's going to make me feel icky. I'm going to get too drunk sometimes, and I need to not do that. My dates are going to get too drunk sometimes. I don't know. There are going to be embarrassing moments, and things are going to happen, and I'll do what I can to make sure those bad things don't happen, but things are going to happen, and I need to just expect that those are likely scenarios. I'm going to fall in love, and they're not going to love me. I'm going to fall in love with people in all likelihood, and they'll kind of love me, but not really. And I'll think they love me, but then they don't love me. And that's going to hurt. And I'm going to cry. And I'm going to want to give up. But I need to have realistic expectations, because that's just how dating works. And it's always worked that way. It wasn't different 50 years ago in terms of what I'm talking about right here. And that's just what's going to happen. And there will be times when I get back on Tinder and I'm going to see my ex-boyfriend on there. I'm going to see my ex-girlfriend on there. And that's going to sting. Or I'll be walking around and I'll see someone I dated, and I will try to avoid them because I broke up with them in a way that I don't feel proud of. These things are going to happen. Okay. What am I going to do knowing that that might happen? Well, I'm going to have fun along the way. I'm not going to enjoy the bad times, but I'm going to enjoy the good times. So when I'm on date 3 and I'm like, huh, this seems to be going pretty well, but I don't know. I mean, date 4, sometimes I hate them. And sometimes later on, I find out that they never really liked me and they were just placating me on date 3. So who knows? But this is a fun time. We're at dinner. We're having a couple of drinks. We're talking. We're laughing. We're sharing each other's lives. This might be the last time I see this person, or this might be the beginning of a forever relationship. I don't know. There's no way for me to know. But I'm gonna live in the moment. Right now, this is what life is about. On the precipice of danger, I am having a romantical moment, and it's fun. And I don't know what, I have hopes, but I do not expect this to work. But if it does work, my goodness, we'll look back on this. We'll remember this day. But in all likelihood, this won't last, because they don't usually last. But I hope they last. I hope this one lasts. I like this guy, but I don't know. Maybe I won't like this guy. Maybe this guy smells funny, and I'll be like, no, I don't like you anymore. You know, that is a realistic narrative. It's not the only realistic narrative, but it is a realistic narrative. And so few people head into dating times with that kind of expectation, with that realistic narrative. They just head in like a lot of people I find that they're like, okay. And a lot of people will build it up for a long time. They'll just be like, okay, I'm thinking about dating again. Okay. Well, so I get when I kind of go through the Rolodex of what I've seen clients do, they'll either have this idea like, oh my God, this is going to be great. And then something bad happens. And then they're like, oh my God, run away. And then they run away for 5 years. Or the other thing that they will say is, well, what's the point? It's not going to work. That's the other attitude I'll hear. It's like, I've tried it before. It didn't work. It's not going to work. And that is just not likely true. I can't predict the future, but it's not likely true. There are so many lonely people out there who are dying to find someone. And when two stars find each other, an explosion happens and good things happen. So it's not a fun time. It's not a fun time to be dumped. It's not a fun time to dump someone. It's not without its annoyances. It's time consuming. But if you live in the moment and you're on a first date and you're like, wow, this is a weird moment. I don't know this person. I'm getting to know them. And we're having some tension, but there's some laughs. And I'm just going to live right now. and I'm going to enjoy it along the way. That's the key. So many people, when they get older and they are looking at very few years left in their life, will say, I wish I had lived in the moment more. I was worried about things all the time. And I didn't take so many risks because I was worried. I wish if I could go back in time, I would not live my life that way. I would have just done things and told myself, enjoy your youth, enjoy your life, enjoy it. It's there for the taking. And I'm not saying to you people listening, you're supposed to be dating. This applies to whatever, you know, that we go through life dreading things and doing things we don't want to and trying to survive. And certainly for some of us, that is our life, that there is no other way of looking at it. But for a lot of us, and a lot of moments, if we just switch the way we look at life, if we just switch our orientation to life of right now, I'm not going to treat this as a chore. I'm going to treat this as something I want to do. How am I going to make this moment my moment? How am I going to make this something that I can get something out of instead of trying to survive something? And dating is included in that. Anyway, let's go on to another email. All right, this next comment is from Lisa was here on YouTube. They ask, what are the best ways to get over someone who loved you dear, someone you loved dearly? What are the best ways to get over someone who you loved dearly? The best ways. So there are two ways of thinking about this. One is dysfunctional and one is not. The dysfunctional one is this phrase, get over. I talk about this all the time, particularly when I'm doing the YouTube live stuff. If you don't know and you're listening to this podcast, I do every now and then, usually on Thursdays, well, always on Thursdays at 2 o'clock, we do a YouTube live Q&A for about an hour. And a lot of the questions that people ask have this sort of tone of like, how do I get over this terrible thing that happened to me? Or, you know, how do I move on? Or how do I cope with these kinds of things? Because we have this culture of something bad happened to you and you need to figure, you need to move on. There's an emotion that's, something bad happened, you're having an emotion, you need to stop the emotion because the emotion doesn't feel good. And we live in a society that supposes that's natural or healthy, and it's a complete opposite paradigm to nature. The other way of looking at this is, how are you going to be human through this process? How are you going to meet your needs, maybe is a better way to put it. So you ask, you know, what are the best ways to get over someone you loved dearly? Well, the first thing I would say is, why do you want to get over them? I mean, I understand, you know, I'm guessing what's happening is you get dumped or the relationship ends or someone died and you're longing for them or you miss them or you have sadness when you think of them. That is life. Like I was saying earlier, to avoid the sadness of loss is to avoid life. To avoid the negative emotions of the ending of a relationship is to avoid relationships. So it's just going to happen and it sucks and I get it, but it's a part of life. Suffering is a part of life and we do not run from reality. We accept reality that all of us right now, you listening, me, all of us, if we go to that place in our soul, we will feel the pain of a past relationship that ended. We will feel the pain of someone who dumped us. We will feel the pain of someone who made us feel like crap, someone who made us feel scared, someone who made us feel like we didn't matter. And what do we? How do you get over that feeling? You don't. That's inhuman to think that you get over that feeling. Emotions are our friends. They're here for us. You know, we have reasons for them. And when you have those feelings, you have self-compassion. Those feelings are telling you, hey, I need compassion. and you can give yourself compassion, or you can tell someone else and they can give you compassion. That's how you get over. That's what your emotions are probably telling you. In the same way, as I always say, when you have a feeling of thirst, you don't try to get over your feeling of thirst. You drink water. You have a feeling of thirst, you drink water. You don't tell yourself, I need to get over my feeling of thirst. I get thirsty all the time. I need to get over it. Well, when you have sadness and pain, you don't get over it. The feeling is telling you that you need, that you are thirsty for love and compassion, either self-compassion or compassion from someone else, connection with someone else. That's what you need. Either the person who hurt you, who which would be great, but in lieu of that, someone else. All right, let's go into another comment here. How can someone get over a major heartbreak sustained 8+? By the way, Colin, if you know from him being around, he is now working for the podcast and he's going through a lot of the emails and stuff and organizing them. And so that's why all these questions right here have to do with getting over someone. So Marissa on YouTube says, how can someone get over a major heartbreak sustained 8+ years ago? How can I stop blaming myself, lowering myself, and diminishing my self-worth? Well, for Marissa, that's a pretty complicated question because, you know, obviously going to therapy, you know, I'll say two things very briefly. One is like I was saying before, sustaining a major heartbreak 8+ years ago and still feeling the pain is to be human. And there are a lot of people out there denying that pain, or they're trying to act like it doesn't happen, or they're drinking that pain away, or they're doing something else, but they feel the pain. You live long enough, you have enough relationships in your past, you're going to have things that will stay with you the rest of your life. And that sucks, doesn't feel good, but it's there. It's human. I don't know anyone past a certain age who has been in enough relationships who doesn't have, you know, a handful of things and relationships in their past that they are still having waves of emotion around. Now, the second thing I'll say is, you know, how do you stop blaming yourself? Well, yeah, you know, it's probably a therapy thing. And so there are probably two things happening. One is that you're experiencing the normal ongoing grief of something that was really hard. And two, you have this other overlapping issue of self-blame that predates the relationship and all like that. Anyway, the Ingrid Joseph on YouTube says, how do you get over heartbreak? I feel like I answered that question. Prab on YouTube says, in my eyes, there's no person better than my first love, which makes it hard for me to have new relationships. How do I get over them? You hear that phrase? How do I get over them? I hope y'all don't do that to yourself. Don't say, how do I get over that? Now, it depends on what we mean by it. I think for some people, they might be like, well, how do I properly grieve it? Maybe that's a better phrase that people should be saying. How do I grieve? Well, you grieve by feeling. Actually, so there are two modes to grief. There are not five stages of grief. That's a falsehood that was perpetuated by some silliness. But we have two modes of grief. One mode is to grieve and feel and to think and reminisce and to hurt. The other mode is to rebuild and have joy and move on. But we vacillate between these two modes for our entire life. So there's no phase to that. For some people, right after the loss, they don't feel the feelings because their body doesn't want to. And then after a time, they feel the feelings. And then they go back to not feeling the feelings. And then they feel the feelings. And we go back and forth naturally between these two modes. And when our society or ourselves prevent ourselves from moving naturally between the modes, that's when bad things happen. So when you say, you know, but you also say, you know, there's no person better than your first love, which makes it hard for you to have new relationships. Well, this is a complicated one. I don't know your particular situation, but there are two things I'll say. One is that it's kind of normal and just keep dating. And it's possible that you just need time. Also, it's possible that you haven't really found the right one and maybe your first love was just particularly compatible with you or just particularly charged with you. I it's not uncommon for someone to have a first love in high school, for example, or college. And after the breakup, they've been dating for a few years and they're like, I think I'm broken because no one compares to the way I felt with my first love. And I'm worried I'm never going to feel that feeling again. Well, I don't know, but in all likelihood, you very much will feel that feeling again. It's a matter of meeting the right person, and maybe it's a matter of enough distance between that past relationship. And it's also possible that what you're thinking of as love is narrow. There's a first love involves a particular kind of feeling that most people will report. You know, I talked about that earlier a little bit. And so it's possible that you're looking for a innocent version of love, one that feels all-encompassing and all good. But after we have that first love heartbreak, we have a more nuanced understanding of love. You know, think about the Pixar movie Inside Out, if you're familiar. In the beginning, we have a young girl who thinks in terms of black and white. Her memories are either all good, or, you know, meaning there's just joyful, or she has memories that are just sad. She has memories that are angry. She has memories of being jealous. She has memories of being disgusted. But none of the things are nuanced. She just is like, okay, that memory is wonderful. I remember playing hockey with my friends. That was fun. I also remember having to move away from my friends. That was sad. But as we age, we learn to blend these things. And that's the whole point of the movie, which is a beautiful point to this movie. That as we age, we learn, oh, we can be sad and happy at the same time. I can remember something that I miss from the past and feel sad that it's gone, but happy that I remember it and happy that I can still recall it. And that, what is that? What is that? It reminds me of a local Seattle band from the late 80s called Sad Happy. It was during the early Nirvana Soundgarden days, there was this other band called Sad Happy. In some ways, they were a lot bigger than Nirvana and Soundgarden, but anyway. So, Sad Happy? Was that the name of the band? Anyway. And in the same way, when we have a first love, we're in that innocent zone, in all likelihood, where it just feels 100% good. There's just nothing bad about it. There's nothing scary. We're in love with an idea, not a person, often with our first love. That's why a lot of people look back on their first love and they're like, why was I in love with that person? I didn't even like that person. I mean, we weren't compatible at all. What was I thinking? It's because often we're in love with an idea. We're projecting something onto the other person and we're falling in love with that, not really what's happening. And only when that reality is so strong that it breaks through the veil of the projection, do we realize, what am I doing? And we break up, or the other person breaks up with us. So it's possible that you'll never find another relationship that feels as intense as that first relationship did. You'll approximate it. You might actually surpass it. It's hard to know, but it wouldn't be uncommon to have it be different. And I'm not going to sugarcoat it. You know, there's pros and cons to that. There's something really quite special about having that projected love, about having that ideal love and passion, where it's just like unbridled obsession with your romantic partner, and they're obsessed with you. Mutual, unbridled, uncomplicated obsession with each other that a lot of people have in their first love. Not everyone, of course, but... And some people experience later on in life too. It's not like you can't have it again, but it's something different sometimes. And there's a lot of ideas about this, and it kind of depends, of course. And someone's going to email me and say, well, actually, I've had an obsessive love 20 times, and each time it's better and better. You know, so there's no way to generalize. That's what I said in the very beginning. It's like these are complicated things. But, you know, you're saying there's no person better than your first love. Well, okay. It's possible that you might not ever meet anyone better, but not likely. And I'm guessing that this person, that Prab, that you're on the younger side and that you just haven't met another person that's better than your first love. That's okay. Yeah, give it time. Sometimes it takes until you're 40 or 60 before you meet the one. And I know that's depressing, but it happens. And it gets back to that expectation around dating that I got to. It's like, okay, I'm going on Tinder. I'm going to meet my husband. Okay, you might, but this might be 40 years of dating before you meet the one where you're like, oh my God, how did it take us so long to find each other? But you can enjoy it along the way. It doesn't negate every experience on the way to that person. You know, there's a lot of poems about this. But let's move on to some more questions. All right, this next chunk of questions, Colin lumped into questions regarding balancing relationships and kids. There's a lot of questions here. Borvarsier on YouTube says, I've been a single mom for 2 years and can't seem to get past the dating phase. I have my kids all the time except for every other weekend. Part of me doesn't want to introduce anyone to them, and it's hard to tell someone new that you can only see them every 2 weeks when my children are with my ex. How long should you wait before introducing a dating partner to your friends? Or to your kids, sorry. How long should you wait before introducing a dating partner to your kids? Okay, end of question. So I'm guessing so it sounds like this person, they had kids, they got divorced, and they don't have the kids for 2 weekends a month. And during those weekends, they are able to date. And so they're not able to date when they have their kids. And so they're thinking, well, you know, if I could just introduce my dates to my kids earlier, then I could actually date and maybe sustain some of these relationships, because it's hard to get past the initial dating phase with people only seeing them twice a month, you know, that kind of thing. Well, so it's a complicated question, and there's no right answer to this, of course, but there are some general guidelines. The first thing I'll say is that in the same way that you might need a babysitter when you go to work, you might need a babysitter when you date, you know? In a perfect situation, you would have a village of people who can take care of your kids, and it'll allow you to go to the store or go to the bathroom or take a personal day or a personal hour or go on a 2-hour date with someone or whatever. And this whole notion that parents, particularly single parents, are supposed to like not have a village is just destructive to everyone, by the way, not just the parent, but to the kids too. So if you can, go on a campaign to get a village. Find other single parents that you can share with. You know, you get another single mom friend, and when she has a date, she drops off the kids at your place for the 2 hours and vice versa. So it takes a village, and that would be the first thing I would say before jumping to, well, how about I just introduce the kids to these people I'm dating? You know, we all understand the risks to that. One is that as the kids become attached to these people and then you stop dating them, that could be hurtful to the kids. It depends, you know, usually parents, single parents can kind of gauge that. It's like, okay, well, if someone I'm dating just comes over and plays Monopoly one night, it's not like my kids are going to get attached to this person, I don't think. But what if, you know, he or she comes over a lot? Okay, now we're looking at something different. And that's a serious issue. When kids get attached, when anyone becomes attached to anyone and that's ripped away from them, there's damage. People depend on longevity and stability and safety and security. And so be mindful of that. But at the same time, you deserve to date. So get a village, figure it out, that sort of thing. The other thing is finding other parents that are divorced, who understand your situation, right? That can help sometimes. Or just tell people you're dating. Just be like, so just let you know, I have my kids all the time, and I'm only without them twice a month, and so I'm only going to be able to date you twice a month. And I really hope that you can handle that, because that's kind of what I need. You know, just have a upfront conversation. With some people, they might be like, not really my thing. I'm guessing if you found people who also had kids, they'd be okay with it. But then you just ask a very direct question, you know, how long should you wait before introducing a dating partner to your kids? The general rule is when you believe that this person is possibly going to be in your life for a very long time, that's when it's okay probably to introduce your dating partner to the kids. It's hard to say. Every kid's different. Every partner is different. Every family's different. But the principle is, do I think this person is going to stick around such that if my kids do become attached to this person, that there's a good chance that this attachment relationship will sustain itself? Now, it's not the end of the world if you date someone for 2 years and you break up and they never see the kids again. It's not the end of the world. It's not ideal, though. So, you know, but it's not going to put a kid in therapy necessarily, but it can, is the thing. So it's complicated. And I understand the convenience of being able to introduce your dating partners to your kids. And again, if they don't get attached to them, and the other thing, of course, is safety, because if you're dating people, you don't necessarily know who they are. And so you just have to be careful with that. The other thing I'll say is that depending on the age of your kids, for them to witness you in a dating scenario, in a dating vibe, can be kind of destabilizing. For them to see you in a vulnerable place can be scary to kids. So it's just another thing to think about. It's pretty complicated. Obviously, I'd talk with a therapist about it. All right, this next message is from Elise. She writes, I'm 46 and have never married or had children. I enjoy being single, but I get a lot of discrimination from society. Is something wrong with me because I'm single and childless by choice? End of message. No. Something wrong with you. Of course, society will think there's something wrong with you. You know, for women to be unmarried, they'll say, oh, what's wrong? What's going on there? And if you don't have kids, oh, you must be a cold person. Yeah, it's ridiculous. A good number of people, and women included, never have kids. So, but they live in silence often, or they live in invisible lives. You know, a lot of people just think, well, doesn't every woman want to get married and have kids? It's just this really ridiculous notion. There's nothing wrong with getting married and have kids, of course, but there's also nothing wrong with being like, yeah, overall, not for me. I mean, it is 100% fine. And my goodness, our society is just some of the dumbest sort of elements. And this is one of them. It's like, you really, people, society, you can't stretch your mind that far to include that it's okay and normal. And why would you want to force people to do something they don't want to do? And what's it to you? You know what I mean? It's like, let's say your favorite thing is to wear high heel shoes and you just judge everyone who doesn't wear high heel shoes. What's wrong with you? You don't wear high heel shoes. Why would you wear flats? Why would you wear tennis shoes? I mean, what is wrong with you? I mean, all of a sudden that's like, it's just a goddamn preference. So, you know, F off. And to have kids it's a preference. It's a life choice. And to get married, it's a preference. It's a life choice. And you could, you know, there's pros and cons to being married, right? There's pros and cons to having children, right? So for many people, the pros outweigh the cons and they have kids. And for some, the pros of not having kids outweighs the cons. So they don't have kids. So, you know, we need to grow up, people. Come on. All right. This next message is from Ain. They write, it seems there's a recurring theme of parents not giving their children enough love and attention, which leads to those kids having relationship issues as adults. I know there's no perfect book on how to raise children, but I have a 2-year-old, a 1-year-old, and a 7-week-old, and a full-time job. Do you have any tips on raising infants, toddlers so close together? Do you have any examples of how to teach them differentiation? End of message. Yeah, wow, that's a lot of work. I mean, 3 kids, 2, you know, you have a 0, a 1, and a 2-year-old child. That is, and a full-time job. Yeah, my goodness. Now, 100 years ago, that was the norm. So people have been doing it for a long time. It's not like it can't be done. And the way you do it, if I have tips, regardless of how old your kids are, it's this. It's attunement. So notice, and every kid's different, and you know probably better than anyone that the same biological mixing, the same two parents can have wildly different kids with wildly different dispositions. So you have to be attuned to their specific personality. You notice their emotions as often as possible, and you react accordingly as best as you can. So your one-year-old seems sad, or your two-year-old seems jealous of the one-year-old, of what the, attention the one-year-old's getting. Well, you attune to that. Now, it doesn't mean you have to give into it. That's actually not necessarily what you want to do. You don't want to give, one of the worst things you can do to a kid is give them the idea that they rule the world, because they do not. But at the same time, they deserve to be attuned to. So you notice their feeling. Okay, Johnny, 2-year-old Johnny. Okay, Johnny, I see that you're frustrated with your younger sister. I see that. And I'm sorry your younger sister is annoying you. That's where you start. Now, beyond there, there's, case by case basis, but that's the key. Children, everyone wants their caregivers, their loved ones to see them. Children know they cannot deal with things on their own. And so when they're having an emotional experience, they're usually any emotion, even good emotions, they're often a little bit scared of it. And if you are there to notice it, and you're calm, and you're not running away, and you're commenting on it, it's very soothing to them. They'll say, oh, okay, well, mom notices me and sees me pretty accurately right now, and I'm looking at her, and she's not freaking out, so everything must be okay. That's very important. And kids on a minute-by-minute basis need this. Now, you also say you have a full-time job. So whoever else is taking care of the kids needs to do that too. So those are my little tips. So teaching differentiation, that's how you do it. Differentiation at the age of 0, 1, and 2 is about attunement and about emotional regulation. And attunement helps with emotional regulation, meaning that the child learns age appropriately what their emotion is and how to mitigate the downside of that emotion. They're angry. And instead of just having a temper tantrum, they look at their anger and they say, oh my gosh, I'm so angry. And they go, mom, I'm very angry right now. And then you notice, you're attuned. You're like, oh, you're angry. What are you angry about? I'm angry about younger sister taking my Legos. You're angry about younger sister taking your Legos. I see you. That makes sense that you're angry. Thank you for telling me that. Let's see what we can do. Okay. When we don't attune to children, they stay in the state that they are when they're younger, which is to just have a tantrum and just to flail and get violent and to scream and to become despondent. And when we see our children and they see that we see them, they relax and okay, well, mom's on the job. Mom. Now, maybe you can't fix it, but you seeing it and convincing your child that you see it will usually take away 90% of the problem for the child. Okay, mom sees it. Mom gets me. Mom understands. And what a wonderful thing. And that's a lot of therapy for all you therapists out there. Stop trying to give skills. I can't. So many trainees, all I'm doing, like half the time, I'm just telling people, stop focusing on skills. Did you become a therapist to teach people skills? Coping skills? Coping skills are great, but the internet can teach them stupid coping skills. Coping skills are not, there's nothing wrong with relaxation or mindfulness practices. Okay, there's nothing wrong with that. And sometimes that is the way to go. But for most of us in therapy, we just want to be heard. We just want to be seen. Do you get me? Am I okay? Am I worthy of being seen? The same goes with kids. And when we don't get enough as a kid, we need our therapist to give us that. Jessica from YouTube says, 4 weeks ago, I just had my third baby, and my boyfriend of 11 years has stopped being a supportive partner. I am genuinely unhappy with this situation and have reached a breaking point. Is there anything I can do to help him become a more active partner and parent? End of message. You know, I'm sorry you're going through that, Jessica. That sounds truly awful. The first thing I'll say is, in the interim, whether you convince him or not, get your village. And this is something that, you know, we all make fun of. Was it Hillary Clinton said it takes a village? It does take a village. We did not evolve in homes separated by miles. We evolved in tribes of about 100 people. And literally a village took care, and this was, and we lived these lives, and many people on the planet today live this way and are perfectly happy and have a lot better outcomes than we do. I mean, we like, oh, we're in this advanced society, United States, we're doing so well. No, we're not. We are civilizing ourselves to death. You know, with all of our separate rooms and screens and cars and jobs and bank accounts, we are eliminating our natural state, which is to be in constant contact with other humans. Of course, the pandemic is making it worse, right? So when you are embarking on a baby-making project and you're like, I'm going to get pregnant, think ahead. Do not say, well, me and my partner are doing fine. Well, what if your partner and you don't do fine? And even two parents is not enough people. That's not how we were designed as animals. Our cousins who are primates, our primate cousins, they don't live in separate caves in these nuclear families, mommy and daddy and three children. That the whole tribe takes care of the children. And the children have many parents. They know their main parent for sure, but they have many people they can depend on and many people watching out for them. So organize your life that way, you know? And if the people in your family of origin are not good supports, find other people. You deserve it. Your kids deserve it. You know, one of the best, I see two different kinds of families. I see families where they do the American dream, where they buy a house on a hill and they wonder why they're so sad and why their parent, why their kids are unhappy and they're separate, you know? And a part of this is economics, by the way, too, and political, where you don't pay women enough. And then a lot of times single parent, you know, a lot of marriages end in divorce. And then we expect the mother to take care of the kids. And then we don't pay women enough. And they're working 1.5 jobs and they're stressed out and they're on their feet all day and they hate their life. And then to come home, they're supposed to parent, you know, it's. There's a lot of political and social forces at play here, of course, but I see that, or I see the nuclear family, you know, two parents and two kids and working all day and separate from everyone else. And I see another family where the kids are seeing their grandparents every day almost, and they see their aunts and uncles and their neighbors and they're friend, you know, their friends' parents. They spend time at their friends' parents' house, and the kids have all sorts of caregivers. They prefer their parents, but they have loving, caring relationships with a lot of people. So I know there are barriers, and I know, you know, it's easier said than done, but I feel like it needs to be said more than it is said, and it needs to be planned. In the old days and in other parts of the world today, this village lifestyle just happens naturally because that's just what's happening. But in today's modern Seattle, mostly American world, you have to engineer it. You have to, through your own grit, engineer a village for yourself because it won't happen otherwise. And so it puts additional strain on families and parents, and then you have to sustain it, right? You can't just set it up. You have to like when someone drops off, someone moves away, you got to replace that person. And it's hard work. And, you know, it's not a good time. But anyway, you know, so that's the first thing, Jessica, is I'm guessing that that might be the case. I don't know. But you're asking, you know, is there anything I can do to help my partner to be a more active partner or parent? Well, assuming that your partner actually wants to be a good partner and a good parent, which is usually true, then therapy is the answer. You know, there's just too many possibilities, and it's the one of the perfect things to do in a situation like this is therapy. It's one of the perfect usages of therapy. There's this assumption out there, particularly against men, it's just like, well, they don't really want a parent. And, you know, men are dogs, they'd rather. Now, take it from a man. Men, when they dig down deep and they're allowed to be who they really are, they're human beings first and they're men second. And as human beings, we want to love and we want to parent and we want to have a stable long-term relationships. We want to be vulnerable, but we're taught we're not supposed to, or we're afraid, or we have traumas, and we try to we fall into toxic masculinity as a warm blanket to protect us from the pain of being human. And when we go to therapy and a therapist really gets that, then they can help bring out the human from the man. And I've done that. One of the most gratifying moments is when I do that and the heterosexual male just breaks down in uncontrollable tears in the middle of the session. And I feel that just the 35 years of pain that he's been holding back, and he's allowed to be vulnerable. And I hold him emotionally, and I ask his partner to do that too. And it's then that the human emerges from the masculine ideal. And now we can move forward. You know, now we can say, okay, it's okay to feel. It's okay to be real. It's okay to be vulnerable. It's okay to be weak. It, you know, quote unquote weak. It's not weak to be human, right? But it's okay to love. It's okay to not know what you're doing. You know, because that's another thing that men are taught. You know, the whole thing of like men don't ask directions, it's true. Research shows that. Women are much better at pulling over and saying, I don't know how to get, now we have GPS, so it's never an issue, but in the old days. But you know, you're putting together an IKEA furniture. Now, this doesn't mean that some women don't do this too, but men are particularly taught this. And in relationships and in parenting, we often don't know what we're doing. And men don't want to ask for help. It's another reason why men die earlier. People think like, oh, men die earlier because of physiology. No. There are so many other sociological, gender-socialized notions that actually cause men to die. You know, most of us understand that women live longer than men. Well, one of the major reasons that they know for sure, because they can account for this factor, is men are taught to not ask for help, and so they don't go to the doctor, or they don't say, hey, I'm not feeling well, and no one comes to their aid. You know, the masculine ideal is to just grin and bear it. Is like, I don't need a doctor. I'm fine. I'll just walk it off. That, of course, if you teach a whole group of people that they can't ask for help, they're going to die soon, sooner than later. Because when something goes wrong, you need to talk to a physician. You need to talk to an expert. You need to ask for help. So when men face parenting and they're confused, and men aren't often socialized young and when they're children on what nurturing looks like, right? Girls are given dolls often, not so much anymore, but in the old days they were. And men are given Tonka trucks, right? And so girls are taught like, okay, here's how you nurture. And for boys, it's like the opposite. Here's how you destroy things. And so men are particularly confused when they head into the baby nurturing activity. They're just looking at this baby. I don't know what to do. And they believe it's them. They believe I can't, I'm inept. And they don't want to face that. They don't want to ask for help, and they don't want to admit they don't know what they're doing. And so they just run from parenting altogether. Happens a lot. So therapy is the only answer. I mean, I don't know as a partner, Jessica, what you could do for that. You know, you can go to your partner and say, I don't know, maybe you could have them listen to this whole section of the podcast. I don't know. But there are books on this too, you know, books for men that are in their language trying to help them out. But finding a therapist that specializes in gender socialization, masculinity can be helpful. Yeah. Anyway. Wow. Who knows with dating questions, I'd be getting into that kind of stuff. And I only got about, I don't know, 2/5 of the way through this document. So I guess I'm going to have to make another dating episode. I think that would be the third one. And wow, if you're still listening, you know, I've been rambling and I'm guessing, you know, there's things in my rambles that don't make sense. Or the thing about these sort of grab bag episodes is that I am trying to answer everyone's questions. And so I'm doing it I'm trying to actually go as fast as I can, and yet I'm talking forever. But one of the downsides to doing this kind of episode is that I can't go thoroughly go into the topic as much as I want to. And so there's always going to be stuff left unsaid. And one of the things that people will, you know, hate me about and get extremely angry at me about is, you know, you didn't mention this. And I'm thinking, well, it's because I didn't have the time to, really. Now, sometimes it's like, yeah, I probably should have mentioned that at the very beginning. But a lot of times it's like, well, yeah, that sort of episode, it wasn't really expected. I was, you know, one of my favorite things to do is when I pick a topic like attachment theory is to spend 6 months investigating every possible angle. And, you know, that's why those deep dives end up being so long, is because I don't want to leave any rock unturned. I want to read every article I can, every book I can. I want to have every angle of this covered. And then I feel satisfied. So, you know, I feel just as unsatisfied sometimes by grab bag episodes. But I do the grab bag episodes for two main reasons. One is that for a lot of people, they really like the sort of, I'm calling them grab bag, but, you know, many topics in one episode, many emails in one episode. I didn't used to do this very often. And I sent out a survey. I've actually sent out a few surveys to listeners, and one of the most popular episodes was these email episodes. I was like, oh, that's weird, because I always kind of felt like those were too fast to be that enjoyable. But a lot of people are like, oh yeah, I really love those ones. Like, okay. And then the other reason why I do it is because a lot of people are emailing me questions these days, and I feel really bad that I can't answer all of them. There was a time when I could answer not only over email, but I could also answer on the podcast every single email that came to me. There were years that I had this podcast where that was true. There were, in the beginning years, if I got any email, I was like, oh my God, someone emailed me. So I still have that kind of mentality of like, if someone emails me a question, I have to answer it on air. Now, I'm not doing that so much anymore, and I just can't. It just would be too many episodes, I suppose. There's not enough hours in the day for me to do that. But I still kind of have that attitude. So that's just another reason why I do these episodes, which means that I can't go into full detail on every single topic, which bums me out and probably can be bothersome, you know, to some people. It's like, oh, well, he dipped into the issue of disability and dating, but he really didn't go in. He should have gone into it more. And, you know, and then people say, well, you should have someone on the show to talk about it. And, you know, I'm working on that. But a little peek behind the curtain on that one is when I set up an interview with anyone, and I've done them. I've been doing this podcast 12.5 years. I've had, you know, hundreds of guests on the show. It is a process, my friend. having people on here, I mean, I have lawyers now that say, you got to get people to sign disclaimers because of this and that. And then because it's a pandemic, we have to do it remotely, which really increases the technical side of things. I mean, before every single interview that you hear me do, I'm probably spending 45 minutes just being someone's IT person, meaning we get on Zoom or some video chatting thing, and I'm for 45 minutes, I'm like, okay, you're in a room that has too much echo, or you're in a room, you're sitting next to a fan, that's not going to work. Do you have a better microphone? There's echo. You have to get headphones. Your internet connection is too slow. Can you find a better internet? And of course, they're mortified, right? They're just like, oh, I'm so sorry, I'm wasting your time. And I'm like, well, you kind of are. Because I send this lot, because I've learned, I send them this long email, like, make sure you do all these things. And like, they almost never do it, because most people just aren't really tech oriented like that. You know, they're just used to sitting down in front of their laptop and doing it. But if you do that, it runs the risk of it being an almost unlistenable podcast. And I've done that, actually. That's the other thing, is I'll spend weeks setting up an interview. We'll record it. It'll go horribly wrong, either with technology or just the interview will just be terrible, or the sound quality will just be horrendous, that I just throw it out. And I just wasted time, wasted my time, wasted their time. The other thing is that not everyone is great on audio. You know, some people speak in with a lot of ums and a lot of pauses and a lot of confusion, and I never know if they're going to be that way too. And, you know, I only have so many hours in the day. But man, if I had it my way, I would interview so many people. Some of our best episodes have been interviewing people. You know, we did an episode not too long ago with someone on the autism spectrum, and I really enjoyed that. I learned a lot, and I know a lot of listeners did too. And so, you know, I'm going to do that, but I just want people to know that it's a lot easier said than done. And unless you're a producer of a radio show or a podcast, you might not fully appreciate just how much work has to go in to producing a listenable episode in which I interview someone that I don't know very well, you know? Even someone I know well can be kind of a thing. And so, you know, definitely something that I'm going to do, but it, like I said, it's a lot easier said than done. And I am a part of a whole podcasting world, right? I'm not the only podcast, and I can't be all podcasts for all people. And there are plenty of podcasts where that's all they do is interview people. You know, they have a routine and they have it down and that's what they do. And my podcast, I've always wanted it to be more of a boutique thing. You know, there are other psychology podcasts out there, like Dr. Dave, the Shrink Wrap Radio, is one that goes back, before me, actually. It's actually the only other psychology podcast older than me. Because when I came on the scene, there were three psychology podcasts in English, and two of them have died in, you know, interim years. And Dr. Dave with Shrink Wrap Radio is still going strong. And we talk sometimes. We've been on each other's podcasts back in the day. But anyway, he interviews people and he's great at that. And so when I think about sometimes people will say, oh, you should interview this person, you should interview that person. I'm like, I would love to, but maybe that's a better thing for a different podcast. You know, maybe that's a better thing for Dr. Dave to do, or the various other psychology podcasts that are out there who are doing that kind of stuff. Because now, at the same time, I don't want to just be lazy and just avoid and just say, well, not my job, I don't have to. It's certainly, not a responsible thing to do, because if everyone did that, certain voices would never get heard, right? But I don't know. I get yelled at a lot for not having guests on. You know, you need to have this sort of person on, and what's wrong with you? You can't talk about this without having this sort of guest on. And, it hurts to be yelled at. And so I guess I'm just trying to tell people where I'm coming from. So that's the end of the dating episode, in which I depress myself with memories of being yelled at. And I get a lot of supportive emails, and you don't have to send me an email, you know, encouraging me. I know you're out there. I know a good number of you right now are sending me good thoughts, and I hear you. I get those emails when I complain, and I hope it's okay that I complain about this. It's a big enough part of my life, honestly, the thin skin issue, that I need multiple platforms to vent my feelings and to get support. It's really no joke. I'm a very sensitive person, and like Umberto gets negative comments, and it just seems to roll off his back. And in some ways, he seems to thrive on it in some weird way. But for me, man, it keeps me up at night, and it makes it hard to do the podcast sometimes. So I hope in my complaining about having guests on and the trouble it causes me will just, you know, maybe stave off a few of those emails. There's nothing wrong with you saying, hey, maybe have a guest on, but, you know, don't say it in a way like, I can't believe you didn't have this person on because you're a piece of crap for not having this sort of person on, which is the sort of emails I get. Anyway, you know what? I feel like I don't want to end on that note, so let's answer another email here. Colin grouped these questions by questions about avoidant dating. All right, so Carla on YouTube said, I violated my partner's trust, and it's brought up their own lifetime trust issues. I have taken responsibility for my bad choice and apologized. How can we move past this conflict without the weight of their past crushing what we have? What are your tips in a long-term relationship with someone who has avoidant attachment? Okay, those are two different questions. So it sounds like Carla has cheated. Sounds like, Carla, you've cheated on your partner. I don't know, but that's usually what people mean by having a bad choice and violating someone's trust. And you're saying, you know, how can we move past this conflict? Like I've been saying, you don't move past it. You do it. You do the conflict. You do the grief. You do the healing. What you're talking about is recovery from infidelity or recovery from some sort of trust incursion. And that takes a long time. There's a lot of apologizing, a lot of anger, a lot of hurt, a lot of shame, a lot of guilt, a lot of talking, a lot of reassuring. And when you're done with that, then you're done with that. And that could take 5 years, which is no joke. Research shows that one of the most universal things about cheaters is they will say, I had no idea how much negativity and how much pain my partner would go through once they found out that I had cheated on them. It's one of the most universal things about cheaters is that they had no idea how much harm it would cause in their life, a one-night fling or a three-month emotional affair or something. They just had no idea how much trouble it was going to create in their own lives and other people's lives. And you have to adjust to that. You have to say, okay, I had an unrealistic expectation heading into this resolution phase of my violation of my partner's trust, and I have to adjust that. And what I tell people is, for as long as you are together, you're going to be dealing with this, which is sometimes not true, but often is. It's not uncommon for someone 20 years down the line to have a wave of hurt and anger about an infidelity that happened 20 years prior. And they'll turn to their partner in a healthy way and say, I'm having a tremendous amount of anger at you right now for you cheating on me 20 years ago. And you process that because that's normal. And so you don't move past the conflict. You live in it. It's the consequence of doing bad things. It's the consequence of being deceptive and cheating. It's the consequence of making a bad choice. When we make bad choices, we incur the consequences. And this is the consequence. And that's life. When we make bad choices, we have consequences. And we can't move past them. We can't have a series of bad... And it's not just a bad choice, usually, if it's cheating. Cheating usually involves thousands of bad choices. Even if it's just one night of infidelity, it was thousands of bad choices. It wasn't just one bad choice. And that's important to recognize that you didn't just make one choice of like, oops, I made a bad choice, boom, sex. No, it was a mindset that happened probably months, if not years prior. It was flirting. It was taking someone for granted. It was emotions going in different directions. It was lack of awareness. It was making a choice to drink that night when you knew you shouldn't have. You know, it's a whole series of things. Now, you're not supposed to be ashamed of yourself, but you're supposed to recognize that you made those choices and you have to live with the consequences. And someone that you love, that you want to have a relationship with, is hurt and angry and doesn't trust you anymore. And that is life. That's what bad choices do. And it's okay. A lot of people do it. A lot of people cheat. A lot of people make that bad choice. But you made your bed. Now it's time to live in it. And it's not the end of the world. And life is messy. And there's a lot of messy beds in the world. Paulina on YouTube says, I'm seeing someone and we enjoy our time together, but I can't tell if he is as into me as I am into him. I'm seeing someone and we enjoy our time together, but I can't tell if he's into me as much as I'm into him. I think he might be avoidant type person. I also think I identify as having preoccupied attachment and I don't want to scare him off with my clinginess. How do I avoid the pursuer distancer dynamic when all I want to do is pursue him for reassurance? So, one thing, so you say you're preoccupied and this partner might be avoidant. That's not uncommon. Obviously, going to therapy would help. Having other relationships to meet your attachment needs will help. The other thing is just to come clean. And this is, this is my personal style that I kind of live like. I do this in life in a lot of different circumstances. I tend just to be upfront about this sort of thing, but not everyone wants to live this way. But I'm actually wearing the merch. You know, I don't know if you know we have merch, but you can go to Teespring. And one of the first shirts that Stacy, my wife, designed is this shirt that says, let me read it. If being healthy means being corny, then be corny. And there's a big corn in the middle. It's along those lines where you might say something like, hey, so I just want to let you know that due to my past relational issues growing up, I have what psychology calls preoccupied attachment, which means that I'm pretty much in a constant state of worrying that people are going to abandon me, whether they are or they aren't. So I will see abandonment signs when they don't necessarily exist. And I frequently am looking and wanting and very desperate for reassurance that I'm not being abandoned. And I've done it before in dating before, and people will call me clingy or needy or something. And I don't want to do that. And I just want to come clean with you. And I just want you to know that that's my thing. And I'm working on it. I'm going to therapy, but this is probably what's going to happen. And sometimes I might be angry at you when you don't deserve it, which isn't fair to you. And I'll try to own it. And, but if you could help me out, if you like me and I like you, but if I don't know how you feel about me, but if you like me at all, there are times when I'm going to ask you for reassurance. And if you could reassure me, that would really help me out. And I know we're dating and we don't know each other that well, but, I just want you to know that. And, I don't want, in the past I would try to suppress these feelings and then I would just get really angry and really resentful and I would punish people that I was dating when I shouldn't have. And I don't want to do that again. I want to be healthy this time. I want to be upfront. And so I just want to set that stage. And I also right now am looking for some reassurance that you like me. You don't have to say you want to spend the rest of your life with me, but I guess I'm just looking for like, do you like me enough to date me for a little bit more time? Or do you like me? What do you like about me? Laugh about it, make a joke about it, but ask, this is my style. You don't have to be that way, but, that I think it's a pretty healthy way. And if the person you're dating is like, whoa, got to run, then, you dodged a bullet on that one. Because to me, if someone said that to me or anyone I knew, I'd be like, holy crap, hold on to that person. That person has a lot of self-awareness and a lot of differentiation. So few people can admit stuff like that. And if your dating partner is avoidant, underneath every avoidant person is a preoccupied person. I want everyone to remember this. Avoidant people are not devoid of emotions. They're not devoid of need. Underneath every avoidant attached person is a massively clingy, needy, preoccupied person. They just hide it from others and themselves. But it's down there. It's the same. Preoccupied people just express it. You know, what we're talking about is attachment insecurity. When we have been taught through life that we cannot depend on our attachments, preoccupied people amp up their attachment needs. And avoidant people suppress it, but the attachment needs are still there. So you can, by revealing your preoccupied nature in a differentiated, non-blaming manner, the avoidant person might be like, oh my God, they're speaking my language. I wish I could come clean about how I feel deep down. The avoidant person is deeply, deeply needy. In fact, often more needy than the preoccupied person, because at least the preoccupied person has chances of getting their needs met because they actually chase people and they let people know when they have needs. The avoidant person never does it. So avoidant people almost never get their attachment needs met. Preoccupied people get their needs met sometimes because they demand it or they're asking for it. You know, they alert others. Avoidant people never alert anyone. Anyway, another question here. BTS GOT7 of EXO Jams on YouTube says, I don't know the difference between wanting support, asking for help, being too needy, and wanting approval for decisions. How can you know if you have a healthy attachment? Let me read this again. I don't know the difference between wanting support and being too needy. I think that's what they're asking. It's an interesting question. Let me think about that for a second. Well, so the thing I'll say, and I've said this before, is that when you have a need, you're not having too many needs because your needs are your needs. And maybe they're coming from a place of trauma, but you have the need. There's no such thing as being too needy. There's only something wrong with being hostile or accusatory about your needs. And when people are saying this person is too needy, it's not that they have needs. It's that they're using their needs as a bludgeoning device. So let's say you have a quote unquote needy person, a clingy person, and they're like, hey, let's hang out tonight, because they're expressing their needs, right? They want to hang out. And the other person's like, yeah, I don't really want to. And then the quote unquote needy person says, well, how come? I thought we were together. What are you doing tonight? Okay. So now that person gets labeled as needy, right? But that's not really accurate. What's happening is they're being hostile. They're being mean. They're being accusatory. They're lashing out. They're controlling. That's the problem. So if the person said, ooh, I have a need to hang out and my partner doesn't want to hang out right now, I have needs that my partner is not meeting right now. Well, what do I do with those needs? Now, I can tell my partner, so I just want to let you know that I'm pretty vulnerable right now and I kind of really need you. You don't have to hang out with me if you don't want to, but I just want to let you know that when you said you didn't want to hang out with me, it made me want to say, no, I really, really, really want to hang out with you because I really need to hang out with you tonight. Or you take your needs and you find other people to attach to, you know. So what do we do with our needs? So that's the difference, is like, and that's what a lot of quote unquote needy people will do, is they'll try to suppress their needs, and that's impossible. You can't suppress your thirst or your hunger or your attachment needs. You can't wish it away. There's no getting over or moving on from your needs. It's what do you do with those needs? How do you set up a life to meet your needs? If you don't have any relationships to meet your attachment needs and some random person comes along that you're dating that meets some of your needs and you pour all of your attachment needs into that one person, then yeah, that's going to cause a problem and it's going to be quote unquote needy, and then you're going to be, oh, I need to suppress my needs. You know, I hope that makes sense. Anyway, last question from user BP on YouTube says, Do you have any tips on dating for someone with avoidant personality disorder? Oh, avoidant personality disorder, not avoidant attachment. Do you have any tips on dating for someone with avoidant? Okay, so maybe BP has avoidant personality disorder, and any tips on dating? Well, you need long-term relational therapy to heal from the traumas that led to avoidant personality disorder. Avoidant personality disorder is not avoidant attachment. Listen to my whole deep dive on avoidant personality disorder, but the central schema of the avoidant personality is, I am deeply flawed. There's something wrong with me. Everyone knows it, when that's a distortion. Not, the person is not deeply flawed and no one knows it. No one detects it. But that's the delusion of the avoidant personality is, I am obviously noticeably deeply flawed in so many different ways, and people are in constant awareness of the fact that I'm deeply flawed. It's sort of like, you can consider it a very extreme version of social anxiety. But anyway, tips on dating. Well, obviously recovering from your avoidant personality, emotional regulation, schema change, and corrective experiences and therapy to make it so that you don't have the schema of deeply flawedness anymore. Trying to, you know, date unrecovered from avoidant personality would be really hard, because you're going to be in a constant state of, you know, while dating, you're going to be in a constant state of like, this person knows I'm deeply flawed. And that is not going to work well when you're trying to date. So now, you don't have to recover entirely from avoidant personality, but you have to have a pretty robust therapeutic system in place to, because dating is hard for people without avoidant personality, right? So that's what I'll say to that. All right. That does it for that episode. Long episode. And I got, like I said, about halfway through the doc, and so I have to do another one of these, which will be fun. This is kind of interesting. Everyone out there, please take care of yourself, really, please, and take care of others. Date when you want to. Enjoy the moment, because you deserve it. You really, really do.